Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're tackling a really fundamental question. Where does our sense of right and wrong even come from? And we're diving into a fascinating perspective on this, all sparked by the thought-provoking material you shared. Specifically, we're going to explore divine command theory as it's presented by Dr. James S. Stiegel in his Christian Ethics lecture.
That's right. And, you know, for anyone looking to get a solid grasp on some of the core ideas in ethics without wading through mounds of dense text, this is definitely for you. Divine command theory, at its heart, offers a pretty direct answer to that question of morality's origins. It's rooted in God's commands.
Exactly. So our goal in this deep dive is to unpack exactly what this theory proposes, what it implies for how we live and make decisions, and to really get our heads around some of the key challenges and questions it raises.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's get right to it. What is divine command theory in a nutshell?
Simply put, divine command theory says that what makes an action right is that God commands it, and what makes an action wrong is that God forbids it. Morality, in this view, isn't based on human reason or societal norms, but directly on divine decree.
And as Dr. Spiegel outlines, this isn't just about vague suggestions. We're talking about a whole range of commands found in Scripture, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, the sources highlight that we're not just dealing with like general principles like love your neighbor. While those foundational commands are certainly there, the Bible also contains more specific instructions across various books. Think of the guidance offered in the Pauline epistles on everything from relationships to conduct.
And it even goes into some incredibly specific stuff, doesn't it? The lecturer mentions the case laws in Leviticus that deal with things like molds in houses or bodily emissions.
Oh, yeah.
It really brings home just how extensive this system of commands can be.
It does. The source material points out that there are scores, if not hundreds, of these commands throughout Scripture, covering a vast spectrum of human life. This sheer volume underscores the comprehensive nature of divine command theory.
Which brings up this idea of obligation. Spiegel connects this to the Latin word legare, meaning to bind. It's like these divine commands create a sense that we are inherently bound to act in certain ways.
That's a key insight. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Think about the feeling we get when we say someone is duty bound. It implies a strong sense of being tied to a particular action because of a commitment or an instruction. Divine commands in this framework create a similar kind of moral obligation, binding believers to what they understand as God's moral standards.
And what's really striking is how widespread this way of thinking is. Even if people don't explicitly label themselves as followers of divine command theory, the sources suggest it's a very common approach for many Christians.
Exactly, yeah. When people turn to Scripture to seek guidance on really complex moral issues, things like abortion, euthanasia, or, you know, questions of social justice, they are, in essence, looking to what they believe are God's directives to determine the right path forward. This practical reliance on divine texts for moral answers shows the theory's implicit influence.
Okay, so we've got the basic idea down, but this is where a really fascinating and long-debated challenge comes into play, the Euthyphro dilemma.
Precisely. This is a classic philosophical problem that dates back to Plato's dialogue featuring Socrates. It's a challenge that has resonated through the centuries and, as the source notes, remains a significant point of discussion when evaluating divine command theory.
So for anyone not familiar, who was Euthyphro and what was the situation that led to this famous dilemma?
Okay, so Socrates was actually outside the King Archon's hall because he was facing accusations of impiety. Euthyphro was there for a rather unusual reason. He was prosecuting his own father for murder. It was a case involving the death of a slave. Euthyphro felt a very strong conviction that his actions were morally right.
Right. And Socrates, in his typical fashion, saw this as an opportunity to probe deeper. He asks Euthyphro for a clear definition of piety, of what makes something good or right.
Exactly. Euthyphro offers a few attempts, but he eventually proposes that piety is simply what all the gods love and impiety is what they hate.
Okay, and this is where Socrates really gets to the heart of the matter with a deceptively simple but incredibly powerful question.
That's right. The core of the Euthyphro dilemma, as it's usually framed when discussing monotheism, which is relevant here with the focus on God, is this. Does God command something because it is good, or is something good because God commands it?
Let's really unpack why this question is so crucial and what the implications are for each possibility. First, what if God commands something because it is already good?
If that's the case, then goodness exists independently of God. There's a moral standard out there that even God recognizes and adheres to. The problem this raises for divine command theory is that it seems to undermine the idea that morality originates solely from God's commands. God becomes more of a messenger of morality than its ultimate source.
Right. So if goodness has this separate existence, then God is essentially just informing us about it, not creating it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what about the other option? What if something is good because God commands it?
Here's where it gets really interesting. And it's the horn of the dilemma that often causes the most concern. If goodness is entirely dependent on God's will, then it seems like God's commands could be entirely arbitrary. The source material doesn't shy away from the really difficult implications some people raise. If this were the case, then if God had commanded things that we universally consider monstrous, like rape, torture, or child abuse, then those actions would by definition be good.
And that's the point where most people, myself included, feel a deep sense of unease. It really clashes with our most basic moral intuitions. It feels like it makes morality completely untethered from anything stable or inherent.
Precisely. The idea that morality could be so contingent, so potentially at odds with our deepest understanding of right and wrong, raises profound questions about the very nature of God and the foundations of morality itself. So how have thinkers tried to navigate this really sharp dilemma?
Well, Dr. Spiegel brings up a few interesting attempts. One is from Richard Swinburne, who tries to draw a distinction between different kinds of moral truths.
Yes, Swinburne suggests that there are certain moral truths that are necessarily good in themselves, things like being just or truthful. He argues that God commands these things because they possess an inherent goodness.
Okay, so in that scenario, God isn't just arbitrarily declaring them good. He's recognizing and commanding something that's already morally true.
Exactly. But then Swinburne distinguishes these necessary moral truths from what he calls contingent moral truths, actions, that become good because God commands them in specific situations, like, say, fulfilling a particular promise you've made. These are dependent on the specific context and God's directive.
The source material mentions that you're not entirely sold on this distinction. What are some of your reservations?
Well, personally, I find that the line between what's supposedly necessary and what's contingent can be quite blurry. It's not always obvious which moral principles fall definitively into one category or the other. Additionally, even with the contingent commands, it still kind of begs the question of why God chose those particular commands and not others. It doesn't entirely resolve the potential for arbitrariness, you know.
Okay, yeah, I see that. So what's an alternative approach that you find more compelling? The lecture touches on Aquinas' perspective.
Yes, Aquinas offers a different way of thinking about it. He argues that God commands things because of who he is. God's very nature, his attributes, his justice, his love, his wisdom serve as the ultimate standard for goodness. Therefore, his commands are essentially expressions and reflections of this perfect nature.
So the command not to murder isn't just a random rule handed down. It flows directly from God's nature as the giver and sustainer of life and from his inherent justice.
Precisely. Similarly, the command to honor God reflects his inherent worthiness and perfection. In this view, biblical commands aren't creating moral truths out of thin air. Rather, those moral truths are eternal and are rooted in God's being. The commands themselves are epistemological. They inform us. They show us what is already morally true based on God's character.
That's a really significant shift in perspective. It moves away from the idea of God's will as the sole foundation of morality and towards the idea of God's very being as the standard of goodness. It feels a lot more stable and less susceptible to the arbitrary command problem.
Absolutely. It provides a more intrinsic and less contingent basis for morality within a divine framework.
Now, Dr. Spiegel also introduces the viewpoint of Peter Geech, which offers yet another interesting angle and starts to connect with this idea of natural law, which we're planning to delve into in our next deep dive.
Yes, Geech takes a slightly different tack, arguing that not all moral knowledge is necessarily dependent on knowing God. His reasoning is quite insightful. He suggests that we need to possess some pre-existing moral understanding to even be able to recognize and accept alleged divine revelations as plausible communications from a morally good God.
So we're not coming to Scripture as blank slates. We bring our own inherent sense of right and wrong with us.
That's essentially his point. He believes we have certain fundamental moral intuitions that allow us to evaluate and affirm certain biblical teachings as morally sound. He even connects this to the Apostle Paul's idea in the book of Romans about God's law being written on our hearts, a kind of innate moral awareness.
So even someone who doesn't believe in God can recognize that things like lying or harming innocent people are wrong, and Geech sees that shared recognition as a reflection of divine law, even if the person isn't consciously attributing it to a divine source.
Exactly. He sees these widely held moral prohibitions as a kind of promulgation of the divine law that is accessible to human reason and conscience, regardless of explicit religious belief. This perspective offers a fascinating bridge between theological and more secular approaches to ethics, suggesting a common ground in our basic moral understanding.
It's really remarkable to see how these different thinkers grapple with the same fundamental questions about morality and its connection to the divine. So just to bring it all together, we've explored divine command theory, the core idea that morality flows directly from God's commands. We then wrestled with the Euthyphro dilemma, that really sharp question of whether God commands what is good or if good is simply what God commands. And finally, we looked at several attempts to navigate this dilemma, from Swinburne's distinction between necessary and contingent truths, to Aquinas grounding morality in God's very nature, and Geech's argument for a pre-existing moral awareness that informs our understanding of divine commands.
Precisely. It really highlights the complexity and the ongoing conversations surrounding the very foundations of ethics. It's not a simple cut-and-dried issue, and each of these perspectives offers valuable insights into the challenges and nuances of linking morality with divine authority.
So, considering Geech's idea that we might have this innate moral compass even before we encounter specific religious teachings, it really makes you wonder, what does that suggest about the fundamental nature of right and wrong and our inherent capacity to discern it? It's a thought that really stays with you. Thanks so much for taking this deep dive with us.